Well, welcome back. This is part three of our exploration this week of Eastern monastic practices, re-examined through mass incarceration today, and how our dilemma and our underground we're creating these days and the cells we're creating can help us see with new eyes spiritual practices that we need and that aren't that ancient, that are as relevant as ever. First, as we see it through our brothers and sisters who are incarcerated, and we find kinship with other human beings that are in that solitary position. And then as we be in dialogue with our own incarcerated hearts inside as well. Would anyone who is here for our smaller afternoon, session two, feel like taking a stab at summarizing some of what we did for those who missed this afternoon?
Looking at different contemplative practices that allow oneself to dive more deeply into themselves, to bring about a sense of awareness with respect to your emotional state, to really one form of prayer in referencing the Psalms is really about being completely honest and open with God about what it is that you are feeling and experiencing. R-rated version, perhaps.
Yeah, we looked at some of the Psalms that get pretty angry and violent, which used to bother me. Like, why as Christians do we read this? And then seeing how my friend Nieners was locked up, and when he started to weep and started to open up, and as he said, I'm not holding shit in anymore, he would find himself yelling and cursing at God in his cell and growing closer to God. And seeing that the Psalms maybe give us permission to pray like Nieners and be violent. And the true, when we're talking about the kenosis, the emptying of the bottle, that there's actually more down at the bottom than we thought. And if we really want to do the kenosis, it means we got to prepare ourselves to see a lot of pain and a lot of raw stuff inside that we didn't think is there. So we keep repressing it, just like Folsom Prison in Represa, California. That as we really listen to those depths, they come up. And then we were looking at the filling of the Molotov cocktail. Secondly, the filling of a new kind of kerosene, a new flammable substance, once we're emptied of all the whether it's the prison cell being emptied of punitive powers, and us being emptied of our laments and our griefs and our pains, we're looking at how quickly in the saints, especially the Eastern Orthodox saints, tears are everywhere. Tears, tears, tears. And how can we see that through a psychological lens of emotional healing and catharsis? The saints really take that seriously as like spiritual kerosene. The fire of God's mercy really runs quickly and responds instantly to the brokenness of heart and vulnerability. And so that Nieners was weeping a lot in that cell, and I think that's when transformation was rapid and mercy came on him heavily. Would anyone who was not here during the afternoon care to read this again? When we're talking about a Molotov cocktail, it's a subversive image, but we need to know what this fire is we're talking about. It's not just anger, rebellion, subversion for its own sake. I feel this is the best description of holiness in the fire that I know. Someone wants to take a stab that was not here.
What is a merciful heart? It is a heart on fire for the whole of creation, for humanity, for the birds, for the animals, for demons, and for all that exists. By the recollection of them, the eyes of a merciful person pour forth tears in abundance. By the strong and vehement mercy that grips such a person's heart, and by such great compassion, the heart is humbled and one cannot bear to hear or to see any injury or slight sorrow in any creation. For this reason, such a person offers up tearful prayer continually, even for irrational beasts, for the enemy of truth, and for those who harm her or him, that they be protected and receive mercy. And in the like manner, such a person prays for the family of reptiles, because of the great compassion that burns without measure in a heart that is in the likeness of God.
That's what we see. And a lot's got to be emptied out before we can really receive more of that. And that real reckoning of what's in us actually helps us experience mercy. So, when we looked at, lastly, and where the sparks come from. And this is a passage I came alongside when accompanying Eaters through his time in solitary confinement, that St. John of the Cross feels that God's love is always throwing out sparks. We just need to learn how to catch them and take care of them. Here's a passage that I did read this afternoon. St. Theophan the Recluse. They've got pretty names. St. Theophan the Recluse says, I will remind you of only one thing. One must descend with the mind of the noose into the heart, and there stand fast before the face of the Lord, there present, all seeing within you. The prayer takes a firm and steadfast hold, and here it is. Even when a small fire begins to burn in the heart, try not to quench this fire. So how we're looking at prayer journaling as another way of those small sparks that are constantly coming of God's thoughts and responses to us, we can easily dismiss them. So we practice going from writing a lament and a psalm, as that green image right there, starting to practice writing down the thoughts that come to us, and the dialogue begins. We practice through paper and pencil catching those sparks and learning how to house them and receive them. And maybe one word we receive in prayer and dare to write down, it starts burning our minds, and a bigger love starts to grow. So, thirdly, then, throwing fire. With the Molotov cocktail, one is emptying, two, filling anew and igniting. It's not just to be a nice little lamp. There's something, here's the subversion of the fire, and I think here's where spreading the fire could be a gentle idea. The whole point is that it grows, and especially in the Molotov cocktail, it's that it's thrown against the barriers of and walls of oppressions in the world around us. So all this came from this story that I'm happy to tell you right now, and it's in the last chapter of my book called Fire in the Hole, kind of documenting some of these experiences of Eaters in the Hole. So when I got to go visit him, when a lot of this was happening, I learned about it by driving like 5 hours away, getting along with a lot of paperwork and emails so that I could go into this visit through the glass. He comes in a white jumpsuit, Velcro, tiny little glasses taped together in the middle because he was starting to read a lot. He never read so much, he didn't know that he needed reading glasses. And we're meeting in this room, and he starts to tell me about, I don't know if you remember from the first night, he had these visions of gardens when he got out. He wanted to have like this garden in his home with fire pits and singing, kind of like he envisioned a holy village, almost, for gang members and for homegirls. And I met with him, and I wanted to document more of his vision, because I wanted to maybe fundraise around this. I'm like, tell me more about your vision. But instead of talking about the garden, he was like, oh, duh, we're only starting in here. I'm like, how does that work? Can't think of a lot of soil in a solitary confinement unit. And I'm like, what do you mean? He's like, man, we're only breaking bread in here, dog. You're in the most finely tuned system of isolation in the history of the world. What do you mean you're breaking bread in here? He's like, oh, let me back up. So we go fishing, right? I was even more confused. What do you mean you go fishing? Has everyone ever heard of fishing in prison? What's fishing?
It's pretty much using a line and trying to go from cell to cell through various ways to communicate or exchange items.
Right. And so what he starts to tell me about is, he's like, look it, and he gets out this floppy little pen, because if they're hard, it can become a weapon. So it's this tiny little floppy pen, it's like 2 inches long, so that he can write letters. And he draws the whole solitary confinement unit in his hand. He's like, all right, we got Oscar here, we got Wacko, we got Monster, we got Rudolph here. And he starts to kind of paint his parish in the palm of his hand. And he lets me know where they all are. And he's like, so when we go fishing, and I hadn't needed him to stop and explain, he's like, oh, well, all right, so that's how we normally run violent hits, you know, communication between gangs about who needs to go get be taken out, and be running drugs, but I use it for different stuff. What we do is it takes hours. You just got to sit there and pull all the threads out of your underwear, out of your boxers, at your socks, you know, like that's why a lot of these guys can't keep their pants up, at least in my unit, is we're pulling all that line out all day long. We're twining it, we get a little plastic cone, we break that in half, we're twining it, we're making line for hours, for days. And then we're on our knees for a long time, and we can't see anything, but we're sliding that out. I'm picturing someone on their knees in their cell, shooting something out for connection with trust that it's going to connect with someone else that they can't see. Mm-hmm. And just what a practice this is. And shooting this line out, just facing a concrete, an iron door, just shooting it out. And then listening as others who are standing on the top tier looking down, a little bit to the right, a little bit to the left. They're all working as a team and whistling and waiting letting them know when the guards are coming in and out. Because if they're caught doing this, all of them get 60 more days in the hole and two more months off their good time.
Wow.
And so they're sliding these lines back and forth until they connect. And then they can go back and forth like a laundry line. And he's like, so what I've been doing for the last 2 weeks, I felt like, man, Chris, none of these guys have the kind of love and support that I have with you and the churches you've connected me to. And I feel bad. I just hear them. They've got nothing. The store comes around. I can get some coffee. I can get some letters. I've got nothing. So I've been using some of my paper to fold up all this powdered coffee and share with guys. And I used to know how to do that because my mom sold drugs growing up. And so I was always making vendors like little paper envelopes full of, you know, different sizes of cocaine or meth or crack. He's like, but I'm doing it with powdered coffee. And I'll put that together and I'll connect them to the line. He's like, but not just that, I thought I want to share something else with these guys. So I looked on the commissary list and I thought, atomic fireballs. I love those. So I've been buying a shitload of fireballs for this. And I've been sitting in my room and I've just been crushing them. It takes a long time. I throw them on the ground until they crush up. You guys know fireballs?
Mm-hmm.
And so they come in that little cellophane square. And so he says he's crushing these until they're flat enough to go under a door. And he connects them to the line as well. And so it takes hours in cooperation to get one line to get it over to Hector. And then everyone working the lines together again to get one out to Wacko. And then he's doing this for a week. All these lines together that he can't even see to distribute this candy and coffee to everyone in this whole unit. And as he's saying this, my mind's really spinning because, you know, I'm a dork that thinks along theological lines all the time. And as I'm picturing this candy coming underneath the guy's cell, and Eaters is saying, look, Chris, I know it's not organic vegetables yet. We'll get there one day. But you've got to understand, for a lot of these homies, that I hear them crying at night. They haven't had anyone visit them for like 8-9 years. They're in there 23 hours a day with no one to talk to them. They don't have anything. You've got to understand, I know it's just a fireball talk, but when that slides under their cell, that's not just candy, that's love. I've never heard a better description of sacramental theology ever. That's not just candy, that's love. This is not just bread, behold, the body of Christ. And then I started thinking about this a lot, that little pink candy is a lot like a wafer as well. And as they're putting it on their tongues, like St. John the Cross says, that love tastes like sweet fire. And I started thinking about this for weeks. That Niners wasn't even thinking with theological intention, but maybe on an instinct, maybe a deeper spirit was moving. I thought, wow, I went from thinking, wow, that's a lot like Eucharist. That's a lot like communion. And that would mean that it's a lot like church. Church happening in the bottom of the pit. Can that happen? Wait, and then I started thinking about it more and reading sacramental theology, and it started flipping. And I started thinking, you know, it's not... That's like communion or Eucharist. The other way around, I started thinking, what if that is the real presence? That's it. That is church and ecclesia, you know, the Greek word for church. That is happening. Fellowship. People are being connected, and he's doing some priestly role there in the bottom of hell, transforming candy and creating a body in communion and distributing a love that comes from prayers and emails. And ladies praying for him by name in Presbyterian and Lutheran churches, hearing his cries through copied emails, that all this is a line through emails, through paper, through money, through underwear threads, through crushed candies, and love finding its way into the pot of the darkest shadows of our prison system. And so I thought, maybe that's the real presence. That's the real deal. And maybe all of our liturgies are training us to see that. And that flip is a transition I've been going through, and I want to propose wherever I go. What if our liturgies are to shape and transform our imaginations so that we can, like watching mugshots, so that when you see the real, you out of the corner of your eye, you get it. That we practice sacrament repeatedly, so that when God is moving sacramentally all the time, we get it. Instead of ignoring what God's doing in the world and thinking the real thing happens in the church room, the church room is like our dojo and our classroom to train our actions so that we can see God moving all over. So I thought that was a really new or weird idea. I'm sorry, I'm let me see these slides. These are some of the guys that are nearest to perish in solitary confinement. When he got out, he has me writing one of these guys. He's been assaulting guards for 9 years. He's stabbed several in the neck. He's only 23. They call him Little Saint. And as we've been writing letters with him and getting to know him more, he was ritually tortured as a little kid, and he was locked up in bathrooms and would escape through the back window. And so he's used to being beat up, locked in a small room, and escaping and rebelling when he's found. And so the cycle is just going on and on and on, and more guards are getting hurt, and he's lost all good time. He'll probably be in there for life. But as we just, through letters and friendship, his cell is shifting. Now he's reading that book, Mountain of Silence, that I showed you on the first night. And so now he's really interested in Eastern Orthodoxy, and he's praying for guards. So I came across this, and I've been thinking about this, and this is like my favorite image in the world now. We're going to go through a lot. That, where should I start? What do you see in this image? This is one of the most popular icons in early church history. This is an icon of the resurrection. What are some of the things that you notice?
Looks like Jesus is pulling people out of coffins.
Okay. Yep, they would say that's Adam and Eve. And Christ's resurrection is not just Christ's, but it's the beginning of the conquering of all death. Cosmically, historically, since the beginning of time.
Being washed of the blood.
What's that?
From being washed of the blood on the right to the white on the left.
Where do you see blood?
The red robes in Revelation, talking about coming out of the tribulation, being washed of the blood.
Interesting. I've never read those commentaries on this icon, but it's possible. Awesome. What else do you see?
I see light and dark. Okay. And Christ bridging the two.
Where's the dark?
I interpreted the individual on the right in the dark red robes as perhaps being darkness.
I see a lot of darkness below them.
Yeah.
You see the earth broken open?
Mm-hmm.
What are those things that are underneath Jesus' feet?
I don't know.
Skateboards?
Bones?
What's that?
Skateboards.
Skateboards?
Keys?
Are they the lids of the coffins?
Maybe lids of the coffin? That's what I thought at first. It could be, but not primarily.
It's a cross.
His cross?
It's the shape of a cross.
It's in the shape of a cross, but it's not a Roman torture instrument cross.
Are they doors of a church or something? Or doors of a building?
Not doors of the church.
Gates of heaven.
Gates of hell.
What?
All right.
What did you say?
Matthew chapter 16, 18, the founding of church, ecclesia. A lot of us are trying to, in 2,000 years after Christ, there's a lot of conversation of rediscovering, revamping, everything of church, and it's a contested word. Is it building? Is it movement? Is it Eastern? Is it Western? Is it Orthodox? Is it Evangelical? It's good to go back to the very first time that ecclesia is mentioned in the New Testament. The assembly, the movement, the people. It's when Jesus is speaking with his disciples, and specifically with Peter, and he says, "On you, rock." And what was what was Peter's real name?
Cephas.
Simon.
Cephas means
rock.
So the church begins even with someone with a secondary tough street name. Upon you, rock, I build my ecclesia, my movement, my people. And the gates of Hades will not stand against it. Did anyone hear this passage preached on growing up? This is the founding of the church. And in all my over-church upbringing, I never heard this verse touched on once. Almost was like an apocryphal text. Matthew chapter 16, 18. It's right there. It's not even footnoted. I think it's right there. Matthew chapter 16, 18. The founding of the church is on Peter. And so it can't be the building, right? Otherwise it would have crushed poor Peter. My ecclesia, my people, my assembly, my posse, my crew.
My community.
My community. My movement. Same sentence. And the gates of Hades. What's Hades?
Hell.
Hell. In the Greek, understand the realm of death. Not even hell in the sense of punishment, but just the realm of all death.
the forces of darkness,
the forces of darkness that
are continuously referenced throughout the New Testament.
The gates of death, darkness, hell, will not stand against it. Now, most interpretations of this, I think, miss the metaphor. Anyone seen any of those, kind of religious Sunday morning jokes or political cartoons, like St. Peter standing at the pearly gates? He's kind of like a bouncer at a party. Mm-hmm. He's got like a long list, and there's some kind of joke about negotiating goodness and badness and how we get into heaven. That's all based on a misreading of Peter and the gates. That it's not about, and the forces of hell will not break into the church's gates, which is, I think, how most of us practice church, is that we have gates, and that either we're a fortress or we can be welcoming, and the church can open its doors to the world. But it's the opposite. Jesus' church, his assembly, has no walls. Hell has gates, and we're trying to get into hell, which is really not what I heard. But I felt like this is what I've been intuiting and experiencing throughout prison ministry for years, is that church has a direction. And its arrow is pointed at the gates of Hades. Mm-hmm. And it's in the gates of Hades, in Jesus' description here, it's not about an afterlife Hades. Otherwise, he would have talked more about afterlife and used future tense sentences, like ultimate future tense sentences with Peter. But he talks to Peter early in his ministry as if this is what the whole ministry of Jesus is. If you think about the Gospels, Jesus is constantly invading the barriers and walls of death in his community. People that are locked in shadow and exclusion and darkness, those walls can't keep his movement out. So first they're going within Israel, right? And they're going to the lepers. And then they're going to the sick. And then they're going to the ultimate sinners. And then they start going to the Samaritans. And then the Syrophoenicians. And then he starts sending them all out, all these different walls. These walls cannot keep us out. And so one question I want to ask us now is, where are the gates of Hades in your community? Because if we don't know where the gates of Hades are, as a church, we don't know where we're going. Where would the gates of Hades be in your community? This is spiritually discerned. It's not an afterlife thing. It might be, ultimately, but it's also a here thing. Where are the gates of Hades?
County jail?
Yeah, definitely. I mean, that's the entry point into mass incarceration, into mass graves.
Yeah, homelessness and all the trappings, you know, mental illness, and drugs, drug abuse, etc.
Okay, so if those would be kind of the shades of Hades, what would be the gates of Hades? Where are those barriers, the kind of frontiers where they're hard to penetrate?
Well, mental illness, certainly. Poverty.
Let's break down the family.
Family. Yeah.
Fear.
What's that?
Fear.
Fear.
No, prejudices we have which keep us from entering.
Prejudices? Fear? Yeah, these can be like the gates between us and the homeless and those who are suffering mental illness.
Our institutions. Our economy, our market.
Our fear. Institutions. Prejudices cannot keep the church out, cannot keep the movement of Jesus out. And so, going back, see all these icons, there's so many iterations of them, you just Google image, icon resurrection. The main narrative of salvation of the early church was not the cross. Mm. That was one point in some Pauline letters. But the main point iterated more loudly throughout the Gospels and in just as many of Paul's letters. So the main event of salvation is the resurrection. Not a substitutionary death, though that got picked up heavily by Calvin 1,500 years later, but the early moment of salvation was that Christ is invading hell. He's not the warden that sends those to hell, but he is the heavenly movement that comes to earth and then rallies up his heavenly movement on earth to even go deeper and invade the gates of Hades. The way Christ gets there is by handing himself over fearlessly to death, entering the realm of the dead. As both Catholics and Orthodox celebrate Holy Saturday, as Christ's dead descent to the dead. And it's even in the Apostles' Creed, Christ goes to hell. Mm-hmm. And he's inviting all of us to go there, to invade it. And that the resurrection is the cosmic prison break. And we are part of that. So see all the little metal shiny things. What do those look like?
Keys.
Keys and locks, you got it. I'm not making it up. Keys and locks. Keys and locks.
So, is the cross the gate of hell?
In their time, for sure.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, in their time, that was Rome's way of saying, you mess with us, death for you. And Jesus says, all right. I'm not afraid to walk through that gate of death and terror and fear. That there's a larger life power that can break the cross. It can. That the cross is not wonderful. The cross is not something to celebrate. The cross was the gates of Hades that Christ shatters in his victory in the resurrection. And so the gates of hell become like toys under his feet. And that like one third of an image of salvation is an opening up of the underworld. This is what we celebrate. The opening up of the underworld, of Hades itself. So then to think about what Nieners was doing in solitary confinement really excited me. I was like, this is Orthodox Ecclesia. This is the original, this is Jesus' imagination. That church is happening, defying all the gates and locked doors of hell. And church was happening through underwear threads and candies and prayers and folded pieces of paper learned from drug dealing moms. That just smacks of Jesus to me. And I feel like that image right there happening in IME is helping me rediscover old school church. Mm. And then I want to then bring that back to one of the looming questions through this section is, it wasn't just fireball candies, it was sacrament. I believe really that God's love and presence was in that as much as any high church or low church communion I've ever been a part of. And Nieners and I still have a kind of fireball movement with guys that use. But it was also underwear threads. He wasn't mailing away to like the Lutheran or Catholic catalog to get some fancy sacraments. He was using what he had.
Yeah.
And I think that's the kind of MacGyver sacramental ethic that that we have. So take a minute, if you have your journal still, and write down, and if you want to rip out a sheet for someone next to you, be still for a minute and think, what unrecognized sacrament has already been operating in my life? No one's shed this light on it. What have been my fireballs and underwear threads? Where has there been ecclesia happening? Maybe bringing people together against forces of isolation? Has it been coffee and tea between women who hate each other? Has it been long-lost letters from someone who's dying in a restaurant that you've got to be a part of? And God's atonement and forgiveness and reconciliation happened through that letter that you've got to be a part of. Just write stuff down. Prayerfully, like an examine, but not just over the last 24 hours, but the last years. What unrecognized sacrament has maybe been in operation? And you didn't know it. But now that you look back, you're in your heart is burning within you. Remember the road to Emmaus? The real presence was with them, and they didn't recognize it until later on, breaking of the bread. I don't know if the breaking of the bread, that was the sacrament. The breaking of the bread triggered their liturgical minds. That, aha, oh yeah, that was Jesus. I was feeling the fire. The real presence of Jesus is normally undercover. And liturgy reminds us later. Liturgy is the operation of memory and imagination so that we can recognize the presence. So just keep writing stuff down. Memories. What was the object that was maybe repurposed? As plain as underwear threads and fireball cans. Creativity. And I said, I'm going to come back to that. For me, this is really what excites me, thinking about the creativity of prisoners. not just a kind of like a recreational art of the upper class, but the real kind of necessity creativity and art of repurposing underwear threads and candies. This is where I think where creativity is born of necessity.
How did they, Chris, how did they propel those threads? Do they have some weight or something?
Yeah, they break and kind of pass the comb in.
Well, that's what the comb is.
That was both the weight and the hook. He got a lot of bruises on his finger from slamming his finger under the doors. And then thinking about another, someone else had a question about community versus individualism in prison. I think solitary confinement units is the height of our obsession with individualism. This creativity is what creates community through those walls. All right, so who would like to just share? Let's hear a few examples of maybe situations or stuff that might have had a sacramental role unrecognized before. Not everybody wants.
I'm in a Course in Miracles group, and there's always chocolate.
At a miracles group?
Course in Miracles. I don't know if they come up with it.
Same one.
I'd have talked a long time probably to have it make any sense. Is anybody else familiar with Course in Miracles? Okay, well, it was actually channeled by a psychiatrist from Jesus. And it's a big, long course that has about 300 pages of text and 365 lessons. And it really coincides with my understanding of Jesus' teachings. So it's pretty exciting. And there's quite a movement in that regard. I'm surprised nobody here has heard of it.
I've heard of it. I've heard of it.
So you and others had like a spiritual fellowship or a group or a weekly meeting?
Weekly meeting.
And there was chocolate?
Yeah.
And that really fostered the communion?
And it seemed to feel that way. It was just like, it was a source of joy and togetherness, and it was something we consumed together.
Okay. Awesome.
Seemed to fit.
Awesome. Great. More examples.
We had at some point a big sewer crew, construction crew in our yard for months, big digging equipment. And there was a terrible foreman, really a foul-mouthed, unkind foreman who never gave his guys breaks and was always cursing at them and insulting them. And I started bringing lemonade and cookies out every day for the men. There were about six of them, and it was for about 3 months. And by the end of that 3 months, the foreman was joining his men for breaks and having lemonade and cookies or iced tea and whatnot. And I didn't think much of it at the time, but as you're speaking, I'm thinking that giving of food and drink to those guys that changed the foreman into a guy who respected his men more. And it did something very strange and magical.
So if Nieder's just saying it's not just fireball candies, that's love siding with the cell of someone who's living completely.
Yeah, I didn't even like this guy, but yeah.
What were you serving them again, remind me?
Whatever, lemonade, iced tea, cookies,
awesome.
Homemade cookies.
What might that have been an embodiment of, a sacrament of? What were they really tasting and receiving?
I was just trying to love them and trying to love the foreman into loving his men.
Okay.
Awesome. But tell them what you said to the foreman, really.
I prayed about him a lot because he was so obnoxious. And one of those mornings when we were talking about talking to God and listening, I was praying and asked God what he would like me to say to this foreman, that it was time to talk to him. So one day, God, I believe, said on the right hand, I want you to tell Joe that I love him. So I went out one morning and just said, I think I have a message for you. I think so. And he said, well, what's that? And I said, well, I was praying for you the other day, and I asked God what he'd like to tell you. And I believe that he said to tell you that he loves you. And he started to cry.
Mm-hmm. Served with lemonade.
But it was after all those lemonades and cookies.
I love it.
So it was kind of a spiritual experience.
Yeah. Sacrament of kindness, of reconciliation, of crossing a gap. There might have been more, even more of a gap there than you were aware of. Maybe there were judgments. Maybe there was class. Who knows? Well, here and there. Any other examples? Possible situations of sacrament?
This feels a little corrupt or something, but my church in Joliet was like obsessed with money and not having enough of it. And then somebody gave us $50,000, and it like immediately became this like divisive, you know, well, I want to put new windows in, well, I want new carpet, well, I want, you know, like, it was like, well, you can pad your coffin, but that's all that's gonna do, you know. And so we took all this time to discern, and what they decided to do was to just like give it away in chunks to we didn't have any relationships with any other churches either. I mean, it was just like a really isolated community by design or by anxiety. Anyway, so we just started like giving the money away in chunks to different communities, and it really sort of mimicked the movement of communion, where it's like you just break the piece of bread, you give it, you give it, you give it, and then in the end, they invited everybody who participated to like come together for fellowship, and the room was like, the church was just like packed. So it actually formed a body. So money of all things being like used, doled out like communion bread to assemble the body of Christ.
Yeah, that sounds like Eucharist to me. Absolutely. Now, especially the bread trains our imagination. It was like bread, but bread is just the starter metaphor to get us thinking about how what is broken and offered and broken up, and then it forms people. And Jesus, even when using the bread, it was a metaphor. He's like, this is me. You know, I'm going to be broken, and I want you to take me into yourselves. And as Christ is taken into all of you, you'll become something bigger. So that we can see that even in money. I love that. I'll probably use that next time I get to share this. That's all right. Awesome. So we can say that sacrament, in the largest sense, creates a body, as Nieners was doing with underwear threads and cans, right? It creates body of Christ. It might be in fragmentary form, a taste and a seed of substance set ablaze with God's presence, and yet it also wants to be united and bring us together. Any other observations we can see from whether it's the money story, the fireball candy story, the lemonade and kindness story? What is sacrament doing when it's truly operating?
Community.
Well,
there's an abundance there. So, you know, the creativity of using what we have reminds me of, you know, even if it seems to be nothing, like the two loaves and the two fishes, you know, it's like it exposes or it reveals that actually there is an abundance here.
Mm-hmm.
when it might seem like nothing.
It feels abundance. And how I would feel abundance sometimes is not just thinking about the quantity,
uh-huh.
but when it's graciously given,
mm-hmm.
there's no exchange going on, like you're just going out and loving this person.
It's free.
We're trying to get something out of them, and the money was just gift. It's just giving away.
Right.
The candy coming to this guy's cell, it wasn't favors, because favors, the economy of favors is
right.
very electric in prison.
Right.
And so it was just, it was small enough that there would be no implication of debt. Just like, it was so humble and almost corny. Here's a little fireball, bro.
Mm-hmm.
A tiny little shot of coffee.
Right.
But the gratuitousness of it, maybe you can say, is part of it as well.
And that maybe the most ordinary or the most simple thing, such as like underwear threads, has the capacity to, or I guess love is so big that it can happen with the most, the simplest or the most ordinary things.
Yeah. Yeah, I think like the underwear threads are so subtle, the guards don't always see them. But the lemonade is so subtle, they're just some money. The ordinariness, it gets
right.
through the cracks of our prison doors, so to say.
Right.
If someone came at you with a big gold monstrous of the presence of God, people would be, all their guards would be up, right?
Yeah.
If Jesus came at us shining in the light of his glory, as popular evangelical song sings, I don't think we would get it. He had to come in underwear thread form to get into our hearts. And so maybe this is why, this is sacrament is our style. It goes low, it gets through the cracks. You guys know Leonard Cohen? Mm-hmm. You know the song, there's a crack in everything. That's how the light gets in. I like that a lot, so looking for the cracks. And I think one more thing I would add, and where we're going in this, is when the sacrament is at its most potent, it's doing the ecclesia trajectory, the church direction arrow, which is towards hell. So wherever there is darkness, exclusion, death, if the sacrament has taken us that direction and somehow getting through the gates of Hades, bingo, church is happening. Jesus' dream might be happening. And so maybe if you follow the sacrament, you're like, oh, in these stories, maybe you kind of start thinking about the sacrament and then you realize, oh, there were barriers there. And even following what God was doing through this stuff, it happened on its own. It didn't even need a sermon for you to try to think about it consciously. But Mieners wasn't trying to apply sacramentally, Matthew 16:18. It was just happening. And then we realized it afterwards. All right. Great. More images. I love these. I'm working on some form of a tattoo of this. Pick your color scheme. But I really feel that prison ministry is not just one more act of charity and do-gooderism. I really feel that prison ministry matches the DNA, the core shape of church mission. And that there is everything can be prison ministry in that sense. But I feel there's something specifically about going to those that have been locked away, shut away in darkness, and condemned, and visiting them and defying those gates that remind the church who we are and what we are. And then maybe that can give us eyes to see it in all the other ways that we're doing in every other act of mercy, charity, Eucharist. Once you start seeing the gates of Hades kind of DNA, so many more verses in the New Testament start lighting up. Christ has made the two groups one and destroyed the barrier, the dividing wall of hostility. Sounds like gates of Hades to me. Dividing wall of hostility. His purpose was to create one new humanity out of the two. So think about building communities for a second. What is the role of sacrament? The stuff that becomes divinized and operating with Jesus' imagination. And divinized is a really popular word for Orthodox too. I didn't hear that. But yeah, to become sanctified, I heard that, but I didn't even know what that means. Sanctified is divinized. It's made more godish. It's made more divine. So we ask this question, what might be an overlooked sacrament in your experience? So relationship is a big form of that. This is when sacrament creates relationship. So that's Mieners at the Tiny Trinity Presbyterian Church in Cedar Wood. And he and I had a certain kind of relationship. It's like I was part of the Underworld thread line. But then once he got out, he and I were brothers and we worked together a lot. But he got stuck on Mary Ellen Byerly. She's a widow. She's pretty tough. A lot of folks in churches didn't like her because she says it how it is. She calls a spade. She's pretty tough. She's pretty grumpy. And she and Mieners got along great. Because whenever she'd like tell someone off, he'd just smile and be like, I like her. Not because he likes telling people off, but he's like, I can trust her. I know where I stand with her. She's going to do the thing straight. And that gets you far in prison. And so they became really close. And he has become like a son to her. And every Saturday for like the last 3 years, he does work out on her property. And she's the loving, strong, stable mother, grandmother, aunt he never had in his life. Mm-hmm. And so that relationship has become a real sacrament for both of them. Of God's adoption and healing her story and her son who committed suicide 4 years ago and is really feeling grafted into the family of God. And these things happen. But she was in that little church that was praying for him to put money on the books to help him buy the fireball candies. So it's all connected. And that's his daughter who got baptized that day. So it's Mieners and Mary Ellen.
What was the prompt? Can you just back up to the prompt for that? Yeah, okay, great, thanks.
So that's just a question we've been talking about. And so one of the things that we're working on now is really taking this seriously. Is not only with underground ministries are we trying to follow that fireball story as our way of how we do chaplaincy now. Because we don't do Bible studies hoping that people self-select to come to religious services, but by Mieners and Mine's intuition and relationships with guys that are the lowest solitary confinement cells and in gang units through letters and through pursuit and putting money on their books. We're just dumping kindness in the people in the cells and the lives of the guys that we most like. So Nina's like connected me with a high level Satanist that was he was cellies with for a few years. And I went all the way up to Clallam Bay and got a visit with him, and he didn't even know I was coming. And so just this strange white boy shows up to meet with this guy. And we met in this tiny medic's office because they didn't even have a chapel room in the solitary confinement unit because no one visits these guys. So they gave us this tiny medical room with like a little curtain and like a stainless steel tray between us. And we talked for 2 hours, and he's becoming one of my better friends. We've had like a year's worth of theological conversation. So we're trying to do the fireball thing as our model of chaplaincy and ecclesia through those who are most in shadow and darkness and hated. And then what we're doing with their reentry is we're realizing that guys need that community, that larger body, in the same way that Nieners needed not just one person, like a full-time kind of gang chaplain like me, but Nieners needed just a community of loving, healthy, normal folks in the parish. And so what we're trying to do now and experimenting is we're doing something called the One Parish, One Prison. I didn't talk about this the first night, did I? Okay, so in Washington State, there's roughly the same amount of prisoners as churches in our state. So just thinking about the math, theoretically, if every church were to take on one individual, didn't start up a big program, do a big training, just a whole church took on one person, started years before they hit the gate, some letters, some visits, getting to know them, the relationship, the whole finances, love, child care, paying off of debts, an open room in someone's house, a used car, someone knows someone who would give them a job. A whole church could take on one person.
Tell me the numbers. I mean, that's hard for me to believe that there's one church for every prison. I think there's many more prisoners than churches.
Well, that's why you limited to Washington State. I forget the hard numbers.
Yeah.
Because we first did that like 4 years ago. I should know that. I need to go back to my notes. But Washington is a very blue state. It's becoming less and less church. That's the ratio for Washington State. But nationally, I've worked with some folks to try to find the national ratio, and we haven't found total churches to total prisoners, but we have found total prisoners being released every year. 700,000 released every year. Most of them go right back to prison. They don't have a community of resurrection around them. But there's, so that 700,000 a year, that's two prisoners for every church in America. And so if every church in America took on two people coming out of prison a year, mass incarceration would be done. Which is ambitious thought, but if you really think about it, it's possible. Churches would just have to work together and love two people really well. And they would interrupt the cycle. And I think, so not only would that theoretically empty the prison system, but I think it would change every church. If every church, they didn't just have one or two deacons kind of take care of them, but it was a whole parish, and we're designing a curriculum with these three pilot churches right now, so that the pastor's involved, because you can only preach your way into this. Because the questions are too difficult and deep. It has to be gospel-shaped questions, not just safety questions. And so we're finding that it's like a dating service right now. We serve with three guys. We have a large Jesuit kind of church in Seattle. We have a tiny little Methodist church with 20 members in a rural county. And we have a mid-sized kind of suburban Presbyterian church. So we have three denominations. We have denominational leadership on board. Each church has five stakeholders, so we'd like to say like five fingers of a hand, so that, you know, when you're building a relationship, it's first a handshake before a hug, and a hug is the whole congregation. So five people for a few years to start writing letters, building a relationship, doing some visits, and then they kind of come back to the congregation, let them know more about and pray weekly for Leroy, for Diego, for Trevor, and that this might be a way that we're trying to do this, the underwear thread and the candies. We're trying to create these twisty tie threads, lines of relationships, which is ecclesia that's slipping through the cracks of denominations and jurisdictions and race and class. And we're learning our way forward. And if this sounds interesting to you, there's a few articles I have printed out in the back that kind of laid out this vision in the Christian century a year or so ago. I encourage you to read and spread the idea. We don't have the full model developed yet, but we're hoping in 10 years we will. That will be a household term in church leadership circles. So that's our hope. Like Curcio, has everyone heard of Curcio? It's like a in Spanish, it's like a small course. It was led by like the Catholics, but now it's ecumenical. It's just like a small retreat in a system that happens in prisons. And all 50 states have.
They have the same retreats. Model at all Cocodus and Tres Dias as the same kind of model as Curcio.
Yeah, they're just cool models that if they start to work and then have enough denominations working together, they can grow. And so we're hoping that this can grow. Questions at this point, ideas, comments? Do a lot of talk.
You mentioned the curriculum. Is that like to support churches in like unpacking their biases that they may have about working with prisoners? Or, like, what does that education look like on the parish level? Or is that still kind of unfolding?
That's a great question. It is unfolding. We did like a pilot orientation for the five people of these three churches. Mm-hmm. So it's like 15 plus people. As well as some of the leadership and Department of Corrections. We needed their buy-in as well. And so part of it was some of the material here, like getting churches thinking theologically about it, not just starting with the graphs of mass incarceration, and here's how you need to have them check in with their parole officer. But we don't want to think just social work style about how do we just process human beings in a mediated way, but to really discover this might remind us of our calling and what our faith is about. So that's part of it. And then Meters being there and telling his story, people being like, oh wow, this is possible. I love Meters. He's way better than Chris. Like, I want Meters in my church. And so that's part of it. And then the part two of the training was then one of our allies in the Department of Corrections invited all of the church stakeholders to come into a prison and then to meet with a mentorship group and be able to have a back and forth exchange, which I thought was pretty cool. But I didn't realize how massive this was for the folks, because I've been in and out of prison gates for many years, but it was huge just for people to literally walk in and out of those gates and be wanted and having to have everything emailed and background checks weeks earlier, and then sit with people in a room just like this, this far away, with men who are doing life, be articulate and vulnerable and kind and intelligent, and just so many misconceptions just falling off that scale. So that's part of the orientation. And then now all three of those churches are at a point where they're writing letters back and forth. And so we just make it, we're not planning how to help them. You're not trying to save their soul. You're not trying to evangelize them. You're just trying to build a relationship. Because Meters wasn't even open to God for 4 or 5 years. He needed to figure out if he could trust me at all. So he wanted me to drop the God cup quick and cut the bullshit, as he said, and just tell me about your life. Tell me about fishing. Tell me about your wife. I want to know you. And so oftentimes that was good for me, because I'm like, oh, I only know how to offer Bible studies and help. Wisdom I think I'm gleaning. And I didn't know that just who I am might be edifying for someone, and how to just be real. And so we feel that that's good for the church folks as well.
Yeah.
So is that helpful?
Yeah, totally. I was just curious about how it all works.
Yeah, and a lot of us were doing a lot of back channeling too, and writing to the guys who were just like, I don't know about this.
Yeah.
And so we're kind of doing our informal orientations of the guys.
Mm-hmm.
Hey, they're just dorky white people. Yeah. Like me. They're just, what do they want? What are they trying to get out of this? And so we talked about that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
With church, like, are you trying to get a feel-good hit out of this? Are you trying to do a ministry moment?
Mm-hmm.
Trying to, you know, all the different subtle exchanges of what we're trying to get out of.
Yeah.
So they're good conversations.
Mm-hmm.
But we'll see how it goes. One of the guys is in work release, 20 minutes away from a church in Mount Vernon, in our county. And he's, I think I have a... So Sarah, the point person at Mount Vernon Presbyterian, they just have like two letters. Does someone want to read Sarah's comments? She had a son who suffered with alcoholism for years, and she's no longer in a relationship with him. So when she got her first letter back from Leroy, he did something in Sarah. Someone want to read her words?
Sure. I received an amazing letter back from Leroy that brought tears to my eyes. I've never been so moved by any letter from anyone. I sent a second one to him on Saturday. I'm so very glad to be a part of this mission and excited to learn where it will take all of us. My eyes and heart are opening to a whole segment of our society which I have only regarded with fear in the past.
1971 letter from Leroy. Just like one fireball can you in the guy's cell might be something. One letter from a guy locked up. More is happening in her than the last 10 years of sermons in her church. Mm-hmm. One letter from someone locked up. And so that, I think that kind of sacrament of relationship, of letters. And most of our whole Christian scriptures in the New Testament are what?
Letters.
Half of them written from James. Or locked up, if Paul was saying that now. So cool, huh? It kind of reminds us, like, oh yeah, this is right there, this is what we believe. Letters became Holy Scripture in our tradition. They weren't recitations from the divine that some of us scribbled down. Other religions have recitation. Ours were just letters, but then informal, loving communications that we see now as God-inspired and breathed. In and out of lockdown settings in the Roman Empire. This is our DNA, this is our game, this is what we're about. Opening up the underworld. So we're rediscovering who we are in these prayer practices, the true self, who we are psychologically, emotionally, and as a church, our mission, our DNA, we can rediscover this in kinship with prisoners. So one other thing that I wanted to, a few other things I want to touch on is, as we're asking examples of sacraments. Was anyone there when I gave a quick spiel about underground coffee and coffee hour this morning? And so it really excites me to think about coffee as a major sacrament in churches. Mm-hmm. People fellowship even more in the coffee hour afterwards than they do in like walking up single file, receiving the body and the blood. So I shouldn't pick them against each other. That's ridiculous. I guess I'm wowed at how much fellowship happens in coffee hour, and that I haven't heard much theological reflection on coffee hour in churches, but that's where people start to really mix and the body really smushes and is kneaded together, and where the leaven rises, where we really become one of the body. And so coffee became a threat to start connecting churches across denominational lines, and as the coffee roasting employs guys coming out of prison, it becomes a sacrament of resurrection, embracing those coming out of the underground. It becomes a sacrament of fellowship, of connection, defying those walls of Hades through employment, through our coffee choices, through our morning cup of coffee. I don't know, I just love thinking sacramentally about coffee, about how we can use that as not just as a way to economically help those coming out of prison, but every time. Just like every time you receive the wafer on your tongue, it's a reminding, it's a retraining of our imaginations of the body of Christ. That every time churches have a cup of coffee, they're reminded of those who are in the underground, and we become more and more of a resurrection people. So that's really exciting to me. And if anyone's interested in connecting your community, your parish, your home with underground coffee, we'd love to help us spread the fire and throw these repurposed sacraments out to the world. Yeah.
Where might I purchase that coffee?
Underground.coffee. Thanks for that.
It's like you had that queued up and ready to go.
and so we're rebranding soon. The bags will look different soon. But what we're hoping to do, and I was talking to some folks at Holden as well, is we'd really love for Holden to be like a hub for this, because Holden hosts so many people around the country, around the world, with I think would be aligned well with our mission.
Chris, where are these roasters?
Skagit Valley, Washington.
Okay.
Just other side of the Cascades. Right
yeah,
here.
Yeah, I know. Are they in Mount Vernon?
Actually, in Burlington, other side of Skagit River.
Okay.
Yep. We partner with Fidalgo Coffee Roasters.
Okay.
And yeah, even the owner of Fidalgo Coffee was thinking this way. Like in the Book of Acts, like when all throughout the Book of Acts, like Jesus is moving with two different people at the same time, and kind of brings them together, Peter and Cornelius, Saul and Ananias. David Evans, he's a Christian, he owns this large coffee roasting company, and he just felt like, I've got this large company, it's doing really well, it's making us money, so what? He was tired of sitting in church and hearing all these kingdom sermons and being like, okay, I'm making coffee, I'm making money, so what? I want this to serve some kind of kingdom purpose. So he came to us when we were just roasting coffee with Zach and a few other former meth cooks in the basement at our old ministry and said, how can I help? And he came as a real servant. It felt like the centurion coming and being like, someone of a big corporation that was doing well, said, how can I help? He helped us import the beans, then he helped us do some roasting training, then he started taking on an intern, and they were like, can we just give all of Underground Coffee to you? And we trusted him at that point, that he wasn't trying to make a dollar off of it, and now he gives full benefits to the employees. He brings people that we bring them to him to hire. And their quality control, their larger workplace environment, and their distribution throughout the Northwest has really upped our game.
Okay.
So that way, if you place an order on a website, it won't just be me and Zach trying to hustle it together, but it'll come to you with a lot more efficiency and professionalism.
Cool.
All right. More of the stories are, there's a few copies of my book back there in the gift shop tomorrow morning, I think. And we'd love it if you want to check out more of this work we're trying to do. It's a new organization, but we're trying to, our mission statement is Underground Ministries. It's not like helps prisoners, but our mission statement is this: Underground Ministries opens new relationships between gang-affected prisoners and the communities to which they return for our mutual transformation and resurrection. We want to open up the gates of Hades for that back and forth resurrection game. And it happens through relationships. The relationships with these men changed me. They've changed how I read the Bible, how I pray, how I think through church history, how I see the New Testament. And my relationship with him, as Nieners would say, is that I couldn't even trust the person in my own cell. For weeks he couldn't sleep because someone, they might stab him in the middle of the night. It's like, so I wouldn't know how to trust a God I can't see.
Mm-hmm.
I need to know if I could trust you. And so it really helped me see relationship as sacrament. Or maybe some of you have heard the phrase, some ministries use incarnational ministry. That it's incarnating the word, that we become the Molotov cocktail. We become the transformed living body on fire, that people taste something of God. We become the crushed candy, that someone gets a taste of divinity because you've been divinized a little bit. Does that make sense? So we want to help foster these relationships, and more than just one helping the other, that in these relationships, something happens. And the more that we undergo some of the Molotov cocktail process that I've been trying to cobble together, just as a simple metaphor, looking at the emptying, the honesty, the grief, the facing who we really are, and in kinship with prisoners. Not just that we're the upper middle class folks who, we've got everything, and we just need to help out some folks who are less fortunate. But as we go through our own self-emptying, inspired by both monks and inmates, we're undergoing a process with those who are locked up. And sometimes those who are locked up are more in the Beatitudes. They're having ahead of us in this. Other thoughts or questions before we wrap up together?
I'm just curious about the initial contact with one of the inmates, and he's really distrustful, and he's saying, you know, what's your gig here? What do you want? What's the line? I want to build a relationship. What do you mean relationship? What does that look like? I'm just curious.
In my experience with prisoners?
Yeah.
It's a good question because this is going to lead us into our last exercise of prayer, thinking about what context we're going back to practice this. Is, I think, motive and discernment. That's a really good question. I would categorize that in my mind as motive and discernment. Is oftentimes when people ask, normally when I travel and speak with leaders together, and someone will always ask, what made you trust him? How did you guys get to know each other? And the room shifts a little bit for leaders and I, because it's a tender question. We like each other. And that's hard to name without it feeling like awkward or squeamish, especially with guys.
Mm-hmm.
That there's just some unexplained X factor of affection, of kinship. Whether God's involved in that or if it's just natural, it's beautiful. And so when people would come to our ministry and feel that they needed to dutifully go help a lot of people, they'd go, whoa, 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 whoa. And I'd ask them a question that they didn't like at first. They said, okay, you're working with these group of migrant girls, or you're working with some of these guys. Do you like any of them? I'm not supposed to ask that question. I know. We're supposed to love them. Do you have a favor? And then normally there's a little bit of a smile that comes up, and you can see that they definitely have a favor. There's something they connect with. There's like it. And to lean into that. I said, I've met hundreds of guys like that. I can't love them all equally. I want to serve them and not have unjust preferential systems. But there were years where I couldn't wait until Meter's letter came in the mail and I was writing 20 different guys. And I think he felt the same, that we leaned into that affection. And maybe some friendship can be a sacrament in that way.
And I guess it was that initial contact that I was trying to envision, that initial contact.
I don't know, he was just bossy. I like it. I like when people are upfront about what they want. He just said, you know, meet with me afterwards. And so few people are that open to just say what they want. We have all sorts of games. They're avoiding being there. I want to meet with you. And so I said, okay, I've got nothing to do. I don't have any friends. Way back early, went into the jail. And he started just inviting into his life. And as his leadership operates in gangs, he's just like, I'm going to cut this visit short. This shit's cool. I want you to talk with Dirty and the homie Wacko. And so I was like, all right, yes, sir. And so it was friendship. It was his kind of bossy leadership skills that he wanted to share with other people. And I don't know, every relationship has its own story. But then when that happens, when those sparks of affection happen, a friendship to listen to it. I don't know if that helps.
Not really. I'll probe your mind a little bit more after the thing.
But yeah, I wasn't trying. I wasn't like, how can I build trust with gang members? I just had to be myself.
And it's the term motivation. When you're challenged on what's your motivation, what are you here for? What you know?
Yeah. Yeah. So building more on that, the motivation could not be I'm here to get my philanthropic kicks. I'm here to save souls. I'm here to convert people to be Christians. I was really glad, as I shared the first night really briefly, that when I got into this, I had been recently suicidal and really cynical about church. So I didn't really have a big evangelistic dream, and I didn't have any illusion that I had my act together. I was lonely and looking for friends. I was looking for purpose. I was looking for where I fit in the world, and maybe that vulnerable search calls into like other angry, sad, despairing young men who are trying to figure out their place in the world. That when you just are real about what you, who you really are, in my kind of self-emptying experience, my kind of kenosis of being suicidally depressed for a while, I think that took me closer to where I really was for the season. And then relationship happens. But if I were like, I'm trying to build trust with gang members so that I can build a gang ministry, which a lot of folks are trying to do when they come volunteer with us, and like, maybe we should bring them on in years. It's just like, nope. So listening to the people that you serve also. So we're going to make about 10 more minutes. I want us to go into about a minute of silence now, prayerfully. I mean, we don't have a beautiful candlelit space like over there, but in the same spirit as during Vespers. I'm going to ask a few questions, but maybe I'll just ask us to close your eyes if you want. Have your journal open and ready, because I wanted to write down a few things to keep in mind. This discern prayerfully. Back to the motivation. Tim, good question. Let's just be still. Let anything that's been rising in your story, in your heart, in some of these images, conversations. You just have space to just focus on that. And I asked a question earlier that was more general, where are the gates of Hades? And I want to ask, Holy Spirit, bring to mind one person. Is everyone here? Who's in spiritually the place of Hades right now? Who's feeling cut off, despised, rejected? Some kind of isolation, desolation. Maybe you already know. just haven't read their condition through this lens. But maybe it's someone you don't know very well.
You do know them.
God's putting them on your mind right now. Jesus, we want to be people of the ecclesia. We're humble. We can't do a whole lot. If there's one other person on the other side of those gates, spiritually, existentially, teach me now how to get through the cracks. I'm going to keep asking a few questions. If you don't know who that person is yet, just stay in that place in prayer. Ask God, is there a kind of sacrament? We're asking the question in the past, unrecognized sacraments that we've already had. Is there something that you want for me to engage, to operate, and to take seriously? Letters. Lemonade. God, love the money. Something that you want to put on my mind right now that I need to lean into in a priestly way, the priesthood of all believers, to lift this thing up and let it become your body and blood in this situation, your divine power to do a breakthrough. Images are coming to mind. More than one, just write them down. We have an amazing capacity as humans to forget what God's telling us. There you go. Maybe it's something that has already been operating between you and this person. So God, we bless that. Let it grow like the fireballs. We lean into it with more prayer and intention. Continue to repurpose it. God, thank you that you took on human flesh in order to transform it. You lifted bread to transform it. Fill our bodies and our minds and divinize us. We can take on your glory. Thank you for your creative love that we get to participate creatively with you in this. Thank you that you're not the warden that we need to fear. You're the beautiful, artistic prison break leader. You want to be part of your movement, your ecclesia. With our underwear threads and passions and the little material we got in our lives would tie us in. Let us taste your love. Let us find kinship and friends in the people that we most fear. In our last 5 minutes, I'm going to ask us to pair up. Just you two right here. Rick and Heather. Maybe Cliff and V, so that you guys are too close. Melinda and Boyd. You two. You two. Renee and Paul. And just take a few minutes and just pray for one another. And something from the charismatics, lay hands on the person and just really pray for them. And be still for a minute and let kind of what rises in your spirit and your mind guide your prayer. And then if you feel like sharing what the situation is, the person maybe on the other side of the gates of Hades that you feel called to, like, share that. Or maybe don't. Maybe just want to use the next 5-10 minutes as we end to just pray for one another and let this kind of fire spread. And that we get used to crossing even the gap between us and entering into kindness and into contact. It's just a way of practicing liturgically, doing that at the moment.